Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
In today's podcast, we sit down with eminent sociologist Francis Box Pivot to discuss how the impact of labor on the American left has changed, how it may not necessarily be the fault of globalization, and how, in fact, globalization may give greater strike powers to labor in the future, a little bit of labor history, and where the new great strikes of the future might come from. Okay, we're very happy to be joined today by Francis Fox Piven, who's on campus giving a talk about how labor is part of the problem in building an American left, which sounds like a great topic and one I'm very interested in. So I guess if we could start, if you could just kind of give the sort of, you know, the quick summation of what the talk today was.
You know, for a century and a half, progressives, socialists, social democrats have relied on labor power, the idea of labor, the reality of labor, as the pragmatic aspect of their theory. It was labor power that would create the force to realize both the social democratic agenda of governmental reforms, the socialist agenda of revolutionary transformation, or just the progressive reformers' idea of taking care of people when they were old, or if they were parentless and youngsters or whatever. And for a long time, that faith seemed well-placed because the ranks of wage laborers were growing, union organization was growing. And in fact, if you look at American history, labor did play a large role in winning the sort of 20th century reforms which moderated the excesses of American capitalism. But now, everything seems different. The promise of labor seems to be evaporating. The percentage of workers who are in unions has shrunk to 12%. Those who are in private sector unions are 7 or 8%. And public sector workers, it's not clear their unions matter much since they don't have the right to strike in the most part. So, and you know, labor is active in politics, but it seems to have been the case for since the presidency of Jimmy Carter, at least, that they're active, but that their demands get very short shrift by their allies in the Democratic Party. So what's going on? And what the financial pundits who publish in the Financial Times or the Economist, their idea of what's going on, they say it's globalization and high-tech economy that is weakening labor. The globalization means that, you know, billions of low-wage workers from the global south have, in a sense, now come into the labor market, either because the goods that they make are exported to the United States or because they themselves come to the United States to compete with American workers. As for what's happening in the American economy, well, high-tech, lean production means much more what's called flexible labor, which means part-time workers, contract workers, and so on, all of which is very, very makes unionization very, very difficult. So, you know, I have a different, is it a theory or a hope? I'm not sure. But I think that these arguments are very one-sided, because while globalization does have some of the consequences they're talking about, bringing billions of low-wage workers into competition with American workers, it's also true that other facets of globalization, or even the very facets that make it possible to import the goods of these low-wage workers, create new opportunities for labor power. And so, you know, what is labor power? If you look at the discussions, the literature, labor power, there are three different kinds of labor power that are really discussed. One is market power. Yeah. Tight labor markets, workers have more bargaining power. Now, with regard to market power, there's no question the globalization explanation is correct and it's devastating. Mm-hmm. Labor's market power in the United States shrinks when lots of low-wage competitors are brought into the market. The second argument is that labor has power because in a democracy, i.e. an electoral representative system, workers are numerous, they can organize, and they can have electoral influence. Well, some, but it doesn't work very well, never has, seems to be working less well these days. But there's a third kind of labor power. And the third kind of labor power was very celebrated in the 19th century. Marx and Engels were writing all around the subject in the Communist Manifesto. It's the idea of the strike, or some Italian autonomia people call it the Great Refusal. The power that comes from the fact that contemporary societies are tightly interdependent. Even people on the lower end of those interdependent relations can withdraw their cooperation, and when they do, they can exercise power over other people who are locked into those cooperative relationships. That's the strike. And the strike is the, in a way, it's this kind of interdependent power writ large. And I think that globalization greatly increases the opportunities for effective strike actions. By effective, I mean strike actions that reverberate, that cause a lot of trouble, that stop the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And moreover, I think globalization lends that kind of strike power to many more groups of people around the globe, just because of extended chains of production, outsourcing, the intense dependence on electronic communications, elaborate transportation systems. However, this is high-risk stuff. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of stuff that has occurred all throughout American labor history and world labor history. This is what workers have done. They've shut it down, and they have taken advantage of the fact that they were the dock workers, for example, and could shut it down bigger. But it's always risky. And it's different from what American unions have become accustomed to doing, how they become accustomed to dealing. They're embedded in union bureaucracies, which have relations with employers. They rely on employers for the checkoff, have relations with government. They're comfortable. They're old. This is not something that union bureaucrats, union bureaucratic leaders are likely to do. So the question is, where is the high-risk, innovative, creative energy for the next strike movement going to come from?
That is a good question. I'm curious. I mean, I very much agree with this sort of analysis that the weakening strike power is a big part, or not strike power, weakening willingness to strike. I'm thinking of, I wish I could think of where I saw that there's a great graphic of strikes internationally, you know, major strikes internationally in Europe. There's all these high, giant bars, and you get to America and there's maybe been five major strikes in the past 40 years or something like that. And you kind of touch on it with the sort of the business unionism problem with that. But I guess I'm sort of wondering if you have any speculation on sort of that last question you started with, of where this new wave of people willing to take that big risk of the major strike internationally might come from, or how you could envision that happening, or if it's just a great hope for us to sit here and
there's some reason to think that it's more likely to come as manufacturing grows in the global south. But I'm hoping it also occurs in the United States. I think there are some workers who have a kind of historically inherited awareness of their potential power, like the West Coast longshoremen. They'll take up any political issue and shut down the port. There's also the question of whether non-unionized workers, after all, unions had to begin somewhere. Mm-hmm. When the unions that we think of as the legendary powerhouses, like the auto workers, the steel workers, the electrical workers, when they started getting unionized, industrial workers were not unionized at all. And the unions were the craft workers, the AFL workers, who resisted industrial unionism. The very idea of industrial unionism seemed to them to sort of smell of immigrants, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So it's not true. It's not the case that the CIO organized the industrial workers. What is a more accurate picture of the dynamic, and it was a closely moving, you know, history moves in very small steps, is that workers, agitated, angry, indignant workers, stirred up sometimes, but it was easy to stir them up by communist organizers, began to mobilize and to do walkouts and, you know, at the drop of a hat, off the line. And that the CIO organizers ran to catch up with them so that they could lead the movement and sort of take charge of the demand for collective bargaining and the unions that grew out of that demand. So I have hope for the grassroots. And the grassroots are never just grassroots. They're always agitational cores in the grassroots. Look at the Day Without Immigrants a couple of years ago. It's sort of odd when I reflect on it now, but I immediately wanted to know who organized it.
Sure.
And my informants could not tell me. And it finally seemed to me that the best answer was the Hispanic disc jockeys organized it.
Sure. You know, I think I wanted to ask, not getting too far afield, but when I saw the title of your talk, you know, labor being part of building an American left, I was thinking sort of the standard historical narrative as I've learned it, you know, in school is that, you know, in the 10s, 20s, and 30s, labor's, you know, in this sort of its big formation, and labor was essentially synonymous with leftist activism kind of thing until in the 60s, and you see a sort of split between the radical left and labor as it becomes sort of mainstream and that sort of thing. And that's obviously grossly oversimplifying what's happened. But I'm curious if that's sort of part of, if you see that as part of this problem, this sort of big kind of split in the middle of the century between sort of the traditional left and labor unions, or if this is sort of taking it far afield from where your discussion's going.
Well, a lot of people do think so. It wasn't so much the split between the traditional left and labor unions. That makes it seem as though it was welling up from the bowels of the labor movement. What happened, rather, was that government policy combined with the Red Scare led the big CIO AFL unions to purge themselves of people who were supposedly communists. The Taft-Hartley Act denied the benefits of the National Labor Relations Board to unions that had any communists in the officers' ships. And then, you know, the hounding of the unions that had some communists in the leadership led to those unions were raided by other unions, and some of them were destroyed. Some of them lived on, but in very shadow of their former selves. So it would, I guess, be more accurate to say that the campaign to purge the leftists from the labor unions did weaken the labor unions. Mm-hmm. And it not only weakened them, but it snuffed out their radical traditions.
Yeah.
So I think that's true. And then, you know, when successive waves of movement action recurred, the civil rights movement, there were few people in the labor movement to mm-hmm. make links between the civil rights movement and the union movement. Walter Reutha did to some extent, but
sure.
It was pretty much limited to Reutha.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he wasn't such a great
yeah.
labor leader.
Yeah. Well, I'm just sort of wondering if, Ben, if you see some of the roots of a problem here and that, and how we might, we, I guess, as a collective project, how it might be overcome in sort of bringing labor back into that sort of fold of American leftism more. Is that going to require sort of a new organization? Like, do you suppose there's any hope for this current sort of bureaucratized unionism
well,
to come back?
Well, you'll only
to
find
America
out
after?
When they have to chase after the labor movement that arises from the unorganized rank and file.
Sure.
And when they have to chase after, if they chase after them, I mean, they may sit back on their laurels and just, they are getting $250,000 annual compensation from union dues. They may not even do that. Then we'll find out.
Okay. I also wanted to ask, too, I was thinking, because in the most, your big famous or maybe infamous article, depending on what TV station you're watching, The Strategy to End Poverty, that's suddenly become a lightning rod again. I was thinking about this morning and that was really predicated upon crisis, like financial crisis, right? They are somewhat intentionally created. But I was curious if you have thoughts about how, and today, it's not manufactured, but we're certainly in the midst of a strong economic crisis today. And if that sort of crisis can be the sort of point that opens up this kind of new wave of sort of rank and file union activism that you're looking for, or if I'm sort of misreading a separate analogy.
I don't think so off the top of my head, but there is a sense in which the financial crisis does have relevance for movement action. It's widely agreed that the subprime mortgages were a very important factor in bringing on the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The banks have been very reluctant to renegotiate any mortgages despite the encouragement of the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been reluctant because they don't want to write down the nominal value of their holdings.
Sure.
But it does expose the banks to an unusual degree to a movement against foreclosures that takes the form of massive defense of foreclosed homes. Mm-hmm. There are 5 or 6 million houses that are on the brink of foreclosure. No, that's big.
Yeah.
So there's a relationship there, I think, between financial crisis and popular action. In the strategy to end poverty, we didn't argue for creating a financial crisis exactly. We tried to spell out in advance the impact on city politics and national politics of mounting demands for legally entitled welfare benefits.
Yeah.
And we said that the cities were vulnerable in part because they were already fiscally stressed. And at that time, New York City, for example, paid 25% of welfare benefits out of its own tax revenues.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they were fiscally stressed. They were also riddled with racial and ethnic conflicts. And given the cities were the base of the National Democratic Party, that would be good reason for the federal government, which was now led by the National Democratic Party, to step in with some kind of reform program. Yeah, I thought that was a very good analysis then. I still think it was a good analysis. And in fact, you know, one of the welfare programs was federalized under the impact of mounting welfare costs. They didn't want to take on, under Nixon, they wouldn't take on the AFDC program, mm-hmm. but they did federalize the aid to the aged, aid to the disabled, and aid to the blind programs. And the result was the creation of a program called SSI. And SSI is much better than those old relief programs run by the states and localities. Sure.
Do you think there's a? Do you think the current Obama administration offers any sort of similar window? Not in that he's the crusading reformer some had maybe hoped he was, but that in the sort of things we're talking about in terms of the peoples that would be organized and the Democratic Party's traditional reliance on labor union votes and that sort of thing. Do you think this opens up a similar window, or has that sort of power block shifted enough that this is not?
Well, in a general sense. Not so much the sort of reverberating effect of troubles in the cities on state and on national government, mm-hmm. although you could see that in the European Union with the Greek financial crisis sparking trouble in the major powers in Europe and in the European Monetary Union. But there is... There's a fundamental relationship between electoral politics and social movements. A politician like Obama has a constituency that importantly includes African Americans, Latinos, and poor people. Mm-hmm. At the same time, his bases of support include Wall Street, white liberals, the professional upper middle class, and so on. Much of what he has done, you can explain by his ties to the traditional Clinton Democratic machine and his ties to Wall Street. You know, where did Timothy Geithner come from, after all? And his vulnerabilities to the defense establishment. But he hasn't done... He's done some, but he hasn't done an awful lot for that other big voting constituency, the poor people and people of color who turned out in unprecedented numbers, mm-hmm. as did youth.
Yeah.
So in a sort of way, you might say we need a social movement, a movement that causes trouble, a movement that focuses attention. A movement that has to be answered if institutions are to continue to function normally. Mm-hmm. You need that kind of movement to hold Obama to account to the people who elected him. Wall Street elected him, to be sure, but they weren't supposed to be the ones who elected him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a movement of people to cause trouble is a great place to stop any conversation. You got a busy day, so I got to let you get back to it. But thank you so much for taking the time out to sit down with us.
It was fun.
I appreciate it.
Well, I can see by the clock on the wall that office hours are over for this week. As always, we'd like to thank the entire podcast team, as well as the University of Minnesota College of Liberal Arts for their continued support. And of course, we'd like to thank you, our loyal listener. We'll see you next time.